Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday today. We're going to talk about apps this segment. The age-old quest for love and companionship has found its footing in the mobile app age. It's called mobile dating, and it's in the growth category. Joining us now to talk about that, how it works, and what it means is Andrea Smith, digital lifestyle editor for Mashable. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Oh, great to be here.
And you're calling us from New York City?
I am.
So is this a really big deal in New York City?
You know, it is, actually. A lot of people are using this in New York City because, you know, even though we've got the bars and the nightlife and everything, a lot of people are just connected. And, you know, they have their phones in their hands all the time. Most of them have GPS on them. We're all textaholics, you know, so we love to know who's around us. And these dating apps are really kind of, you know, finding their footing.
A question for our listeners. I'm going to ask you if you've used a mobile dating app. Give us a call and tell us about your experience. 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org or join us on Facebook. It's quick. It's easy. Just go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Andrea, I wasn't surprised that there were mobile dating apps, but I was surprised that, according to a report by Flurry Analytics last year, that Americans now use dating apps more than online dating sites, and that it is growing faster than the number using all apps. Is that your understanding? And wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I saw also, you know, a number about 40 million singles are using these personal platforms. But here's the thing, you know, Match.com and eHarmony, they're great. They really did great. I know more people who got married from people they met on those sites, but they take a long time to fill out those profiles. And anyone who's ever done it knows, you know, you agonize over it, the perfect picture, the perfect profile. The dating sites, they're just about here and now. You know, it's not as long to fill out a profile. It's a quick Q&A. And I think for today's kind of more distracted users, it's just a much easier process to sign up for.
My guest is Andrea Smith, digital lifestyle editor for Mashable. We're talking about dating apps. Questions or comments? If you have an experience you want to share, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So that's one difference, is the detail that you go into with the online dating services or matchmaking services. That's a big difference. What other differences? And then you mentioned also the here and now. So this is something you can really do on the fly.
You can do this on the fly. I mean, you kind of, you know, some of them, you're just hanging out, you know, you're looking to see who's in the neighborhood. If you've signed up for one of these services, you can kind of just do a little GPS search and see if somebody who matches your profile is there. Some of them, one called Zusk Mobile, you can flirt with people on your phone. There's one called Plenty of Fish that lets you send messages to people who are in the area. And again, they're really very GPS based. So, you know, maybe it's good for somebody who's traveling and wants to just, you know, maybe meet somebody, a friend, and go to dinner or a movie or something in another city, or has moved to a new city and is looking for new friends. Also a great way to use these sites.
So what do you mean by flirting? What does that constitute in this day and age of, you know, mobile apps?
I would say that it's texting. You know, it's really sending quick messages back and forth, you know, short texts, and this particular mobile platform calls it flirts. Some of them call them budges, emails. You know, they have emails, but then they also have budges. And some of them, you know, you can really view somebody's profile and see a whole lot about them. Others, you can actually look through people's photos. So there's really a whole gamut of ways that these things are done. You know, it really depends on what you're looking for and how much information you want to put out there.
So I've got a couple questions as far as the profiles go. If you're already registered with something like eHarmony or Match.com, now they just call themselves Match when it comes to the mobile app. But if you're already registered with them, do they have an automatic mobile app for you?
Yeah, actually, okay. eHarmony does have a mobile app. You can use most of the features on their mobile app, and it's pretty complementary to the web platform, mm-hmm. but you still have to take that relationship questionnaire and do it on the web platform before you can use the mobile app.
And what kind of profile do you get with a mobile app? You said it's much less detailed than you may do with eHarmony. But so what are you getting?
You're really getting just more about who you are, what you like to do, your interests. You know, again, maybe some pictures, maybe not pictures, and where you live. It's really a, you know, not as extensive a questionnaire on these apps.
And let me, before, say I'm going to go to, you know, Milwaukee. And I'm going to find out who lives there. And when I get to Milwaukee, I'm going to find out who's nearby.
You can do it more once you get there because it's based on your GPS location. So once you get there, you can sign into Blender is one, for instance. It's a location-based app. And it's almost like a social network on a mobile app. And you list your different interests, you know, in different categories. And basically, you can just search for other people who have the same interests as you. And then you can see in real life who's around you with those interests. And then you ping them and say, hey, want to get together?
One dating app has been shut down. I guess they shut down themselves because it used profiles of men and women who were nearby, even if they had not signed up to be a part of the service. That's kind of creepy.
That is creepy. Yeah.
How did that work?
Be careful. You know, I'm not sure of the particulars of how they got your information and signed you up, but I know that with a lot of these, they really, experts and people that we here at Mashable have talked to, you know, they really say to exercise caution in these because there's a lot less information known about people. I mean, eHarmony and Match.com, they're going to screen these people for you, and they do, you know, for the most part, a pretty good job. So on these mobile dating apps, you know, they really say think about safety. For instance, you know, pick a username. You don't necessarily want to put your real name out there.
Mm-hmm.
So find a username. Same thing with your cell phone number. You know, you don't want to give somebody you don't know your cell phone number. And if you're going to meet with somebody, you know, common sense says always do that in a public place.
There's privacy controls too.
Yes.
What do you need to protect?
To protect in terms of your privacy?
Right. I mean, you're already kind of putting it out there. You're saying don't give them your cell phone number, but they're able to text you?
Within the app.
Gotcha.
Within the mobile app. So
okay.
They can't really, like, they can't reach out and say, oh, I like this person, because you're not really giving everyone who's subscribe to that app your mobile number. You are just signing up with your mobile number so that text messages come to you. So nobody really knows your mobile number.
If you're using the GPS component, what if you're deciding, okay, you're going to try to meet this person, you're going to meet at a coffee house or at a bar or something like that, and you get close enough and you see that, should you quick turn off your GPS?
Because
they can see you coming, right?
I mean, that's been happening for years. I mean, how many times have you heard about people going on a blind date, you know,
right,
and they walk into the restaurant and they see the person, they go, oh, no, that's not for me, and hightail it out. So, yeah, and, you know, all of these also say, because they all rely on push notification, and that's, you know, a lot of these apps, when you load them onto your phone, they ask if you'd like push notification. Many people say no for many apps, but for these, you have to say yes, of course, if you want to receive messages from people. So all you simply have to do is turn off the push notifications, and nobody can reach you.
And you can retain your anonymity.
Exactly.
There's a caution out there, beware of aggregation. What are they worried about there? Do you know?
Who's cautioning aggregation?
Well, we had to do with the dating app that was shut down because it used profiles of people who were nearby but who had not signed up to be part of the service, that they were aggregating their information.
Hmm. That I'm not really sure of where that information was coming from. Again, I'm not sure of the particulars of where that information actually came from.
And then another issue I thought was kind of interesting is be aware of sensitivity of information. If someone, in other words, if someone's asking you about the name of your first pet, you ought to be concerned about that.
Absolutely, because that's the number one, password most people use. I mean, that's the way that most people, you know, use their Gmail account or their Outlook account. And, you know, if you want to, I'm sure your listeners have heard about what happened to the tech writer last week who had most of his cloud-based content wiped out because somebody was able to hack in and change his password. So those are the things that somebody can find out about you and get one thing, get that information, find the next level of information, and they can actually do a lot of damage with that information. So aside from not using your pet's name as your password, never give that information.
Don't use it first and then don't give it away. There's also been an issue about how to keep minors out of the lineup here.
Yeah, you know, that is always an issue, always a problem. I mean, of course, you have to say, you know, you're above a certain age. I mean, look, Facebook wants you to be above 13.
And no one's ever lied about their age before, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, and how many fake IDs are getting kids into bars. So, you know, that's always going to be an issue. You know, it used to be that they would say you have to have a credit card to be able to sign up, but there's, you know, 15 and 16-year-olds walking around with credit cards left and right these days.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just really something that good parenting and open communication, that's where that really has to come into play.
And I've read that the gay community has adopted to mobile dating pretty well. It's one way to find out if you're the only gay person in the room, someone said.
Well, that's true. But you know what? There actually is a mobile dating app for the gay community. And so
which one is that?
It's an all-male location-based app. It's called Grindr.
Okay.
And it's for the gay crowd. And it's, you know, it's a GPS-enabled app, and it pretty much does what it's actually, it's interesting. Blender, which is a really good app, was created by the creator of Grindr because it did so well. So Grindr is for the gay community and Blender's for the straight crowd.
And, you know, some say that there's a somewhat inaccurate perception that mobile apps are meant for casual dating, for meeting new friends, which is why they fall under the social networking label, but not necessarily. You could meet the love of your life?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I just think that this is a way of meeting people easier and quicker. And again, for today's, you know, really stressed, busy people who just keep putting it off and don't want to fill out a huge, long profile, it's just a faster way. And I think that people also are realizing, hey, I can make up my mind pretty quickly. You know, I can talk to you for 5 minutes and realize, no, you're not for me. And also remember that, you know, the way today's digital natives communicate is via text. They're used to talking via text anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that they can get a sense of somebody in these kind of texting sessions and email sessions. There's one that actually allows for an hour of email interaction before it cuts you off, before you have to decide if you want to take it to the next level. And I think that, you know, it's a really good, efficient, it's like speed dating. It's an efficient way to figure out, do you want to, you know, meet this person somewhere or to, you know, take it to the next level.
And just one last question, Andrea, how much does it cost?
Most of them are free.
It's just the advertising that they're making from it.
I'm sure there's a ton of advertising there. Right. Most of them are free. And the good news is that if you do find someone and you do get married, then there's some really great apps for couples out there for staying in touch.
Oh, okay. Next time, okay?
Yep.
All right, Andrea Smith. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Andrea Smith is a digital lifestyle editor for Mashable. Coming up, we'll hear from author Andrew Bloom, the name of his new book. It's called Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Go west from Tampa Bay, away from the GOP convention, out to where the housing bust hit home in Florida, where orange trees used to be.
This is actually an abandoned grove that we closed on last November.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Boom, bust, and economic politics in a swing state. We'll have that story and the numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
And Marketplace is tonight at 6 here on 89.7 NPR News. And join our station along with WOSU-TV for live coverage of the Republican National Convention. NPR and PBS will bring you special coverage from Tampa. It's tonight, beginning at 8. 76 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine with a high of 82 today. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 58 degrees, more sunshine and a high of 82 on Wednesday. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
So what is the internet exactly? Back in 2006, then U.S. Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska gave his definition of the internet. Let's listen.
They deliver in other ways, but they want to deliver vast amounts of information over the internet. And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material.
Okay, so he got a lot of, he was mocked a lot at the time, especially on late night talk television. But those who mocked him did not necessarily include those who knew better. So what is the internet? Writer Andrew Bloom asked that question and from his research wrote the new book, Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. Bloom writes about architecture, design, technology, urbanism, art, and travel, and his articles and essays have appeared in Wired, The New York Times, The New Yorker, Bloomberg, Business Week, Popular Science, The Atlantic Online, and many, many more. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard that excerpt from the 2006 speech by former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, now deceased. Everyone joked about it when he said that the internet is a series of tubes. Tell us why you decided to write this book and name it Tubes.
Sure. Yeah, no, that clip makes me smile every time.
Yeah.
I was writing mostly about architecture, about buildings. But the strange thing was that I was spending all of my time sitting in front of my laptop screen rather than going out into the world and looking at buildings. And that seemed particularly strange given that this world inside my screen had no physical reality of its own. You know, it was just the cyber world, the virtual world. There was nothing back there. And then this strange thing happened. My internet at home broke, and the cable guy came to fix it. And he sort of followed the wire from this big clump of cables behind my couch out to the backyard behind my building. And then there he saw a squirrel running along the cable. And he said, I think that's your problem. I think a squirrel is chewing on your internet. And of course, this seemed preposterous because the internet, you know, the internet is not something a squirrel can chew on. It's this, you know, thing that's changed everything from dating, you know, to revolutions, to shopping, to you know, everything in our lives has changed with the incredible arrival of the internet. But it also appeared to have this physical thing as well. It appeared to be something a squirrel could chew on, and I got this image in my head of what would happen if I yanked the cable from the wall, you know, and I wondered how far I could follow it, how far it would go. And that's what I spent about 2 years doing, essentially following the cable and visiting the places of the internet.
Where did you start? Well, besides the jumble of wires behind your couch, beyond that, where did you start this?
Practically speaking, I started by talking with a lot of network engineers. I started on the phone. I started trying to understand what the internet was other than just this transcendent set of protocols, this like big amorphous blob as the major image of the internet looks like. And where I ended up very quickly was at places called internet exchange points. And if the internet's a network of networks, Facebook's a network, Google's a network, Citibank's a network, Verizon's a network, if the internet's a network of networks, these are the places, the buildings, where those networks physically connect to each other. So you have a big refrigerator-sized router with blinking lights and usually yellow cables coming out of it belonging to one network, say Time Warner, and you have the refrigerator-sized router belonging to another network, say Facebook. And in these buildings, there is a yellow cable connecting one to the other. And that is the kind of inter and internet.
You wrote that the internet began in a room in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Like where?
The room, that's an interesting spot. It's an interesting spot. It's in 1969, Labor Day weekend. Actually, I guess we're coming up on the anniversary of it. A guy named Leonard Kleinrock, who was a computer science professor there, who's still there. He's still in the same office. And this was the spot where the first node on the ARPANET, which was the predecessor network of the Internet, kind of the first network that was then connected to other networks to become the Internet, this was where the first node was installed and switched on. And the amazing thing is that when I visited about 2.5 years ago now, the machine, the IMP it's called, the Interface Message Processor, another steel refrigerator-looking machine, was tucked away in this sort of conference room across from Kleinrock's office. Totally uncelebrated, even though this is a sort of important historical place. I mean, this is the spot where the Internet was first turned on. I haven't seen it yet, but in the time since, they've actually managed to put in a sort of Internet museum and reading room to kind of celebrate and sort of mark this as an appropriate place of pilgrimage for those of us interested in the physical reality of our digital lives.
You, in your journey, you visited Google, which is also not an amorphous blob of stuff. It's a real place. And you said they weren't very welcoming. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, well, I visited, if one of the major pieces of the Internet are these exchange points, the places where networks meet, another important place are the data centers, the place where data is stored. And I focused on two of those, the first ground-up buildings of the number one and number two most visited websites, Facebook and Google, Google and Facebook. And I had very different experiences at those two places. At Google, I sort of invited myself over. They said, "Okay, sure, come see our facility." This was their first built data center in a place called the Dalles in Oregon, east of Portland. And I was expecting something of a tour, expecting some explanation, because by that point I'd visited dozens and dozens of these internet buildings and had been welcomed, enthusiastically by the engineers who work there and were eager to make sure I understood how this all worked, and so I could then convey that to readers. At Google, it was the opposite. I was given a tour of the parking lot. We sort of marched across this campus. I was shown the Googler's organic garden, which would have been nice, but it was wintertime, so it was just this patch of dirt. And then when I asked sort of basic questions like, "What does this do? What goes on inside this building?" I was given non-answers. As the guy said, "I think that's information we have internally, but it's not something we often share." And it's like, well, obviously you know what it does. That's information you have. And this was completely shocking to me because, Google is the company that knows the most about us. Google is the company that often holds all of our emails, that keeps a record of all of our search queries, that knows what websites we visit on the Internet. And yet of all the places that I visited, they were the outliers. They were the ones who were least willing to share anything about themselves. And that was quite hypocritical. It was quite striking to me how little they seemed to believe that the rest of us had a right or even the capability to understand what it is that they do.
Is that what you make of it, that they don't think anyone has a right to that information? They went to the trouble to aggregate it. It's none of the rest of us beeswax, or?
Well, they say that the reasons they say they don't allow visitors inside their data centers are for competitive reasons, that their technology, their sort of the machinery in there, is so much more advanced than their competitors that you can't even get a glimpse at it. That's one reason. The second reason is to protect our privacy. But that's not, I don't see that as an entirely valid reason. It's not as if I'm, carrying some secret device in my pocket that's sniffing the air and, extracting information from that. More likely, if someone's going to steal your data from Google, which happens all the time, they're going to hack into your Gmail account. And that's a very frequent occurrence. A lot less likely that me in a supervised visit is going to somehow invade people's privacy. But I think the reason that they don't is that it's a company with an incredibly arrogant culture, I put it. I mean, they really believe that they are the best at what they do, and justifiably, they often are the best at what they do. But they don't think that the rest of us can understand it. To put it bluntly, I think that Google thinks that we're stupid. I think that Google thinks that we really don't. I mean, we give them so much for free. For the most part, we don't pay for Google. If you buy ads, you pay for it. Mm-hmm. And it's not entirely clear. The value exchange isn't clear at all. And it's quite striking to me that they don't meet that expectation. They don't meet the responsibility that we give them with a sort of return, trusting us to understand what they're doing with it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Andrew Bloom. We're talking about his new book. It's called Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. If you have a question or comment for Andrew, get your question or comment in quickly. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Facebook page is a quick and efficient way to communicate with us as well. You made me think of a scene in that movie, Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
With Will Smith, when you talk about the engineers were eager to have us come in and show us around, because it reminded me of the guy who was hiding the alien and said, you know, we don't get out much. You know, they were all in a dither because the president kind of invoked that image in my mind. Finally, someone notices us.
that is fair. I mean, I remember when I first mentioned to my editor at Wired magazine that we should do something about wires. He's like, oh my God, you know, we forgot about the wires. You know, it's definitely the sort of a the hidden underbelly of the internet. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about apps and gadgets and, you know, and the business side of Silicon Valley and things like that. But the infrastructure really flies under the radar. I believe that we should know more about it. I believe we should know where our internet comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that as we both ask more of the network, you know, as we both are, whether streaming more movies or want to do things like high-definition video chatting, known as telepresence, we'll ask more of the network, we'll know more about where it comes from. But I also think that as the cable companies get, you know, sometimes somewhat more nefarious in their dealings, whether, you know, prioritizing different traffic, like wanting you to use their video streaming service rather than a Netflix or an Amazon,
mm-hmm.
as that happens, we're gonna ask more from the network politically. You know, we're gonna want to know more about where our internet comes from, in the same way that in recent years we've wanted to know more about where our food comes from.
Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to talk about Google. Welcome to the show. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Yeah, I work for a data aggregation company, one of the big players in the industry. I happen to also be local to Columbus, Ohio, but I applaud Google for not revealing that information and holding everything from the physical security to the informational security very sacred and not sharing that with the office.
He brings up an issue I wanted to ask you about as well, Andrew. We're starting to worry a lot about cyber warfare these days, but if the internet is a physical infrastructure, how safe is it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm a journalist. I believe in transparency. I believe that it's better for all of us if corporations open things up a little bit so we have a better sense of what they're doing. That's a starting point. I mean, the other thing that I learned from talking to network engineers is that their biggest concern is not the secrecy. Their biggest concern is people's lack of knowledge about how things work and what they're doing is. I'll give you an example. I wrote a lot about one of the most important sort of internet crossroads in the country, a building in Ashburn, Virginia, near Dulles Airport, owned by a company called Equinix. And a piece of that chapter was excerpted online with the admittedly sensational headline, "The Bullseye of America's Internet." And the company that owns that building, Equinix, all that week tweeted, "We are the bullseye of America's internet. We are the bullseye of America's internet." Partly because that's what they do. They sell their space. They're very happy to be called the most important crossroads of the internet. But also because again and again, what I heard was that the concern among the people who run these companies and the engineers who run these buildings is not that they remain secret, but that by not knowing about them, you run the risk of either legislation or business decisions that are harmful to these companies and to the internet as a whole. And in some ways, that brings us back to a series of tubes. I mean, the reason Ted Stevens was so roundly mocked was because he didn't seem like he got it. And again and again, Washington doesn't seem to get it. But when you realize how few people understand how the internet works, it's not surprising that Washington doesn't get it. Few people do. And that was really what I was trying to do by looking at it in physical terms, understanding more about how it fits together and where our internet comes from. Because I think, you know, when we talk about the cloud, the more we give to the cloud, the more responsibility we give up. And that seems to be getting into very dangerous territory.
Greg? Did you hear that?
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks
Thank
for
you
your call,
much.
Greg.
Sure.
From Arlen on Facebook, Arlen writes, "As a broadband service tech, I can tell you nobody in the high-speed data business calls our lines tubes, calling the lines something like hardline, trunk, plant, coax, or fiber are often used, but never tubes. And yes, squirrels are the worst enemy of your connection to the internet. So tubes, you agree, disagree? I mean, is that...
No, tubes for me, the engineers often will more often use exactly the words he said. They'll more often say pipes if they're going to say tubes. You know, but a tube is a hollow metal cylinder filled with things. And every internet building I visited was filled with hollow metal cylinders, often filled with fiber optic cables. And the things under the ocean, there are hollow metal copper cylinders filled with fiber optic cables. So I know a tube. I know a tube when I see one. For me, the title also often was a way of bridging, bridging that that tongue-in-cheek, what the internet isn't with what in fact it is, which is a series of metal tubes filled with fiber optic cables.
So getting back to the issue about cyber warfare, that's been in the news a lot lately. That's what a lot of us are worried about. But what about the physical infrastructure? Is that safe?
I do believe it's safe. These places are quite well protected. They're just as much protected because of the value of the equipment inside, the financial value of the equipment inside, than any threat of terrorism. There is a lot of redundancy between these most important buildings. Yes, this campus in Ashburn, Virginia, is very important, but there's other equally important buildings in New York City, and they back each other up. They're quite large buildings. It's hard to do something. It's hard to really take them down in any nefarious and substantial way. And if you did, maybe it would slow the internet down a little bit. Maybe it wouldn't. You'd be perceived as trying to take down the global economy. Again, it's not a threat that it's not something that keeps the people who own and operate these buildings up at night.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger threat, you may remember when there was the big storm at the end of June in the Washington area, the derecho.
Right. It
was there too. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, I forget it started there. Yeah. And Netflix and Pinterest and Instagram and sites like that were taken down by that. That was a lightning strike on one of the data centers near sort of adjacent to Equinix's Ashburn campus. That's a bigger threat than terrorists. That illustrated the physical vulnerability of it. But again, keeping these places secret is not the solution.
You wrote that the Stop Online Piracy Act was irrelevant to the people who actually run the internet. You said that these people like to stay out of the policy debates, which kind of surprised me. Why is that?
It was because of the gulf between what Washington was talking about and what they were actually able, what was realistic. This might be overstating it a bit, but after talking to network engineers and reading about SOPA and PIPA at the end of last year, it was as if Congress was saying, hey, attention airline industry, from now on all planes must fly upside down. It was just technically not something that was capable of working.
Okay.
And at the point where they said, you must do this, the response to the engineering community would have been, we can't. It doesn't work. That's not how things happen.
You mentioned earlier, we're running out of time, but you mentioned earlier something about sniffing the air, and you do actually write about there is a smell.
Yeah.
That you were able to isolate from all the smells in the world. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the internet, again, we think of it as this thing on their screen. We think of it as this amorphous blob. I try to sort of get down to brass tacks and sort of say, what is this thing physically? And try to experience it with my senses as much as possible, what it sounds like and what it looks like, and indeed what it smells like. And any internet building you walk into, any data center or exchange point or any of these places, it's always, you walk in, the same thing always greets you. It's a little bit like burnt toast, a little bit like a sort of new car smell, the kind of plastic off-gassing,
mm-hmm.
a little bit like a really powerful air conditioner. And it was funny, I finished my research about a year ago, and I hadn't been inside the internet in a while. And just recently, I visited somebody I talked to in Portland, Oregon, inside Portland's piece of the internet. And I walked in, and I hadn't smelled in a year, but there it was, that same distinctive smell of the internet.
Well, Andrew Bloom, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Bloom, he's author of Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher from 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, as the Republican convention begins, Boston Globe reporters Michael Cranish and Scott Hillman return to talk about Mitt Romney and some of the latest developments in his campaign. Their book, The Real Romney, has just been published in paperback with a new afterword. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher and Untangling the Secrets of the Human Genetic Code. Join us for that discussion tomorrow morning at 10 on 89.7. And you can always learn more about All Sides with Ann Fisher, all the topics and guests, by liking the show on Facebook and following WOSU All Sides on Twitter. And join 89.7 NPR News and WOSU-TV for live coverage of the Republican National Convention. Starting tonight, WOSU will bring you special coverage from NPR and PBS. That special coverage from Tampa, it's tonight beginning at 8. 77 degrees with sunshine, a high of 82. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58. Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com. And All Sides continues here on 89.7.
Joining us now is Russell Holley, a tech blogger for Geek.com. We're going to start off with talking about something I never thought we would actually talk about, and that's fixing your devices yourself, which just seems completely improbable, Russell. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back. And it's not improbable. It's really not as hard as it sounds.
Well, you know, it's funny because it's a lot of us feel like it's as hard as it sounds. And yet, if you go to the companies that make the devices, they're not a big help either. So you wanted to talk about how to use ifixit.com. That's ifixit.com to keep your devices alive. What's ifixit?
I go to ifixit all the time. These guys, they're a company that decided a long time ago that what the internet really needed was a database of free repair manuals for everything imaginable. Every piece of electronics in your home, there needed to be a free repair manual online for doing just kind of basic stuff. Everything from just doing simple things like removing the casing from your desktop or things that seem really complicated until you look at the steps and you realize that this is stuff that you can do on your kitchen table. And recently they've gotten a lot of attention by doing these really high-end teardowns of mobile devices as they come out. So like the new iPad and the Nexus 7 and anytime a smartphone comes out, these guys get a hold of the phone the day it comes out and they take pictures step by step as they completely dismantle these things and show you what's inside and how easy or difficult it is to perform any kind of repairs on your own.
I love it that it was started by a couple of guys in their dorm room at Cal Poly. Of course, this is California Polytechnic Institute. I mean, it's sort of a virtual mecca for technology nerds. Are these instructions really useful for the rest of us? Have they been able to make it? I hesitate to use the phrase, but dumb it down for the rest of us.
They've done a really good job of making it incredibly simple to use. And if it's a matter of not feeling like you have the right tools, the ways that this company makes money is through donations. And also they sell tools, the tools that they use in their photos. So you can literally use the same things that they use to do the things that they do. But really, these are all, these are not advanced tools that they're using. And they take really high quality, high resolution photos. And typically, there's comments that go along with each question, and a lot of users have taken these instructions and created videos and things like that. And so, the thing that I found about iFixit is that it's really useful for anybody who wants to do, basic, simple things. Not necessarily take your phone apart and see how it ticks, but if you've got a laptop that's running a little bit in age and someone, the kid at Best Buy has told you that what you really need is more RAM, but we're going to charge you $300 to do it. The guys at iFixit have shown for just about every laptop that's out there right now that it's really easy to do that kind of stuff on your own. You can do it on your kitchen table, and it requires really minimal parts for most computers.
My guest is Russell Holley, blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question for him about anything technology related, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. I thought it was interesting that lots of people use these instructions for lots of different purposes, forensics, for example.
There's no real shortage of what you can, what you can't do, you know, with this kind of thing. And that's what they really wanted to accomplish with this database was that, you know, any amount of, you know, information extraction or, you know, removing specific parts. If someone, you know, someone takes a laptop and drops it off the side of a building, chances are the hard drive might still be somewhat usable. And so, you know, removing that kind of stuff in a safe way is you know, just a brief example of the kind of thing that they make really easy to find.
So how big is the database now anyways? How long has it been around and how big is it?
Oh, it's really grown in size over the last, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years. They've gotten a lot of attention, like I said, doing these teardowns, and it's given them the funding that they need to do just about everything. I don't know exactly how big the database is, but mm-hmm. every time I want to take something apart or try and fix something, these guys have it. And from the look of the website, they've got enough, you know, conversation for just about everything that they've had it for, you know, for a significant amount of time. I think that they have a lot of relationships with companies that are, you know, in such a way that they get the devices the day they come out. And so chances are, if you're buying something off the shelf at Best Buy, the repair instructions are already available on iFixit.
Now, you said that they make money by selling the tools that they use. What about parts? Because they had to buy old broken computers, kind of like, you know, have a little junkyard for computers so that they would have the spare parts. What about the rest of us?
So they do have some parts that they sell, really kind of basic stuff, but a lot of the things that they advise on buying are things like you know, like RAM and hard drives and stuff like that. And there's no way that these guys would be able to be price competitive on a lot of those things. So typically they just recommend things like Amazon for the parts that you're looking for.
And are you satisfied that I think I've already asked that question. I guess I still would be afraid to fix something like my iPhone myself. And you just recommend people look at it first?
It's definitely something where you know, the instruction manuals are really easy to take a look at and determine for yourself, okay, this is something that I'm capable of. They break it down very step by step. And the cool thing about devices like the iPhone is that a lot of the things that are kind of silly things, like maybe there's been a lot of younger kids recently who have taken the iPhone and replaced the glass with different colors. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing is really easy to do. But if you go too much deeper than that, then you run into a couple of problems. And it's interesting. They focus a lot on Apple and they compare a lot of other devices to Apple. But they found that they're really harsh on companies that make devices difficult to repair or difficult to recycle, which is another thing that they focus pretty heavy on is when a computer is finished, you know, they really don't want to see it end up in a landfill because it can't be recycled. And so they evaluate each device when they do these teardowns. They evaluate them on their repairability and their recyclability. And they've actually found a lot of Apple devices recently have been, you know, they've not been very easy to repair and they're almost entirely unrecyclable.
So if you want to find out about those issues, you could go to iFixit.com and they talk about that stuff as well.
They have, yeah, the massive database. Anytime they've done a teardown, it's one of the first things that you see when there's a search bar. And you search for the device that you're looking for, and if there's a teardown, it'll be right there, and then the instruction manuals will be right underneath of it. And they have apps for iPhone and Android if you just want to, you know, browse from your phone or tablet. They're definitely a very well-organized group of people.
Let's turn to note-taking. Everybody does it, almost. You wanted to talk about Moleskine notebooks and how they work with smartphones and tablets now. I thought you were joking when you said you wanted to talk about that.
So I do a lot of things digitally. I know that I try to recommend as many people do things paperless as possible. Uh-huh. But there are definitely times where, you know, the tactile response that you get from writing things down is just beneficial for certain situations. And I've had Moleskine notebooks ever since I was a child. I really appreciate the size and the just the quality of those books. So I typically always have one with me for whatever reason. But I run into that same problem, you know, for someone who is trying so hard to be paperless, taking things from the Moleskine notebook to, you know, my tablet or my laptop or something, I end up basically just rewriting everything.
Mm-hmm.
The guys at Moleskine have actually paired up with a company called Evernote. And Evernote does a lot of things with note-taking for Apple and for Google, where, you know, you can write things down and it transcribes it into actual text that you can copy and paste in other places. And they're really great for things like to-do lists and stuff, but it's still not a piece of paper. So the guys at Moleskine and Evernote have actually created what they're calling these smart notebooks. And they're really just regular Moleskine notebooks that have codes and color patterns on the pages to make it so that when you take a picture with your smartphone, it actually takes the information from those pages and converts it into text using the Evernote application on your phone. So you can write all day long in a Moleskine notebook, and then when you get home, take a picture with your phone, and all of the information that you've written will transfer digitally. And I've tested it a couple of times, and it is fantastically useful.
Okay, so do you have to have great penmanship, number one? And what about people who write in sort of a shorthand like I do after 30 years as a journalist?
I have some of the worst handwriting ever, and it does a fairly good job picking up my stuff.
Interesting.
As for shorthand, it's not great with shorthand. It does really good with certain things. You know, it'll pick up a lot of kind of, you know, jargon stuff. And Evernote doesn't have the ability to enter in, you know, specific things. So you can't, you know, basically create like a cheat sheet for your shorthand in Evernote.
Right.
But it does offer some really interesting kind of side features, you know, for things that you want to, you know, take down notes for and just have them be saved online.
If I say repeatedly use YR for your, for instance, will it literally then pick up the YR at least?
It'll definitely pick up the YR, and Evernote can do that kind of translation. You know, kind of when it's on the computer,
okay.
It's just not going to do it automatically.
All right. And the one feature of the service will be the ability to create a directory of notebooks that can be shared. Can you talk to us about that?
This is a feature that's kind of a part of Evernote now, is that you can take the information that you've created, you can, you know, take all of the pages and put them in notebooks, and you can share them either via email or with other people using Evernote so that it becomes a collaborative tool.
When is it going to be available, and how much does it cost? Because Moleskines aren't cheap to begin with.
Moleskines aren't cheap, but the smart notebooks, the 3.5 by 5.5 books, and Evernote Premium, they start at about $25.
Okay.
And that's, you know, kind of a standard size of the smaller Moleskine notebooks,
mm-hmm.
and they're starting to ship in about 4 weeks, I think.
Okay. Just in time for Christmas, maybe?
Yeah, it should be just in time for Christmas.
Okay. You wanted to talk about Google gift cards. It's something that you've talked about before. The Google Play Store finally has them.
Yes, yeah. It's something that is just now starting. It's just rolling out to a couple of stores. They come in $10 and $25 increments, and it is beyond me why it is it took Google this long. But if you're considering getting, you know, someone an Android tablet or an Android phone for Christmas or for a birthday or something like that, then, you know, you will be able to get them gift cards as well to help them get started with apps and movies and music that they can all buy through the tablet.
And you can have a wish list component too, which is nice.
Yes, the wish list component is set up now, and you can actually share the wish list with other people, kind of like you do with Amazon. So you can leave not so subtle hints as to what you want for your birthday and stuff.
We have a tweet from a listener. They ask, are the rumors true? Is Apple doing a smaller iPad? Isn't a small iPad just an iPhone?
So there are definitely rumors that there's going to be an iPad mini. There's been nothing confirmed about that. And really, the goal would be to have it be just ever so slightly smaller than the iPad. Personally, I think the 10-inch tablets like the iPad are too big to carry around places. But the iPad mini would be closer to 8 inches, just a little tiny bit bigger than maybe Google's Nexus 7. And that would the hope is that that would make it more portable, so people would be able to, you know, maybe keep it in a purse or keep it in a backpack and be inclined to take it with them everywhere. Because if there's one thing these guys want, it's for you to never put these things down.
Let's talk about, speaking of Apple, the Apple versus Samsung patent case. A California jury came back with a sweeping win for Apple in the company's ongoing battle with Samsung, finding Samsung guilty of willfully infringing on Apple's patents and on many, many more counts. A little over a billion dollars in fines. What do you make of this?
This is a really weird case, and it's not even the first or the fifth time that something like this has happened between Apple and Samsung. These guys have been suing each other over the last year all across the world, and the results have been different everywhere, which is really odd because they're pretty much suing each other for the exact same thing all across the world, and the results have been strikingly different. Samsung has won in some cases. In Korea, the courts in Korea banned all Apple and Samsung products uniformly, just said you guys can take your football and go home.
Like a pox on both their houses?
Basically, it was, that was just before this verdict.
Okay.
And so here in the U.S., a jury of nine people determined that Apple was in the right here and that Samsung had willingly infringed. And it's important to keep in mind that these are old devices that they're talking about. This is the iPhone 3G and the original Samsung Galaxy S. So these things, when you're looking at new devices, like you're looking at the iPhone 4S or the Samsung Galaxy S3, both of these companies have effectively moved on already. But these issues here are being resolved. And if you look at the two devices previously, the 3G and the Galaxy S, it's kind of easy to see where Samsung, you know, picked a couple of cues from Apple and went crazy. But there's been a lot of talk about the jury rushing through, you know, the stuff that was going, or maybe not paying the closest of attention to some of the details in the case that are kind of critical. So it seems like Samsung is going to be able to appeal. So the verdict may not stand. And it's important to understand that this was a really, really complex situation. There were over 700, there was exactly 700 different questions that needed to be answered as part of the verdict. And that spanned across 30 different devices. You had the 28 Samsung devices that were believed to be infringing, and then the iPhone 3G and the iPad. And the jury, you know, which was comprised of nine people that were not smartphone experts. They were not, you know, they were not software engineers or anything like that. And they were able to answer those 700 questions about 30 devices in less than 3 days. And I don't think I could do that in less than 3 days, much less agree with eight other people who might have opinions. So there's a lot of question as to how the jury handled this situation. And I definitely think that Samsung was in the wrong in part of this, but I definitely don't think that, I think this case is far from over.
One blogger wrote that it's hard not to feel like the world as we know it has just changed forever. And I think, wow, that's pretty dramatic. We're almost out of time, but do you feel like the world has changed as we know it forever?
I honestly don't think the world has changed at all. Like I said, both of these companies have moved on. The Samsung Galaxy S3, as far as I can tell, doesn't really infringe on any of these patents. You know, Samsung and Google both, you know, found other ways to do business when it comes to making sure that Apple's patents weren't infringed on. And so I think that this will end in some kind of cross-licensing agreement like we originally saw between Microsoft and Apple, and that this is something that we'll forget about. This is definitely not the end of the smartphone world as we know it.
Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to joining us for our listeners. The All Sides staff includes associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, All Sides volunteer Rose Joe, with video production by Rich and Amber Karzminski. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.